The only activity that we actually do in the same way that God does is creation. That's it. It's like a baptismal font. Once you do that, you step into infinity.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. James Lee Burke is one of the greatest mystery writers of all time and one of the most successful. He has written 46 books, including 24 novels in the series starring Dave Robicheaux, an honorable but haunted detective work in the streets and bayous of South Louisiana. Burke's latest book turns the spotlight onto Robicheaux's loyal and unpredictable sidekick, Cleet Purcell. Cleet arrives in bookstores June 11th. James Lee Burke grew up on the Texas-Louisiana border. Now he lives up in Montana, where at age 87, he still writes every day and deep into the night. He told me about his writing process, his series of odd jobs, and his fears for the country he loves. This one's special to me. Here's our conversation. I want to start by asking about a photograph. So early on in this new book, Cleet, Cleet talks about a photograph that he can't shake from his mind. And it's of a Jewish woman and her children walking into the gas chambers during the Holocaust. Preparing for this interview, I reread a couple of your earlier books. And there's a scene in Heaven's Prisoners when Dave Robicheaux talks about that same photograph. Can I assume from that 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 photograph is real?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's haunted me ever since I saw them. It's horrible. It's just absolutely horrible.
Well, I was going to say, can you tell me a little bit about how you encountered it?
It was just in a magazine or maybe life's photography that, and it's the photographers they had at those camps were so stark, you never get them out of your head. But I was going to say, a few people mentioned that the reference to Heaven's Prisoners,
and that book was 30 some years ago.
Oh, I don't see anybody. This is what has occurred in my life. My first cousin was war hero of our family, and I based my book Wayfaring Stranger. And he was there at one of those camps, his outfit liberated, you know, Patton, what was rolling across the country. Well, but not only he, my friend Lester Hemingway was there, Ernest's brother. And a third party named Charles Williford, who was my friend of over 20 years, the crime writer in Miami. He was there. He was in the 10th Mountain Division, tank man. My cousin had the Silver Star and three Purple Hearts. Charles had the Silver Star. And Lester was at the 22nd Division. Oh, anyway, but I didn't mean to get into all that. The point is that all three men would not talk about it. They would not talk about it. They had seen the worst of the worst. And the daughter of Lester, my friend, told me once, Lester killed himself. But she said that he never got rid of it.
Obviously, in your books, you know, both Dave and Cleet are Vietnam vets and have a lot of flashbacks and bad dreams and that sort of thing about those times. Is that where you sort of drew those images from your friends?
That was not the intention. The pictures that came out of Europe in 44, then 45, say something about the human race. It's not about one incident. It's terrifying because we're right back there now. We're right on the lip.
I've heard you talk about this in other interviews. Obviously, you've been around a while. You've seen it from both ends, so to speak, from earlier and from today, and you feel like we're in a precarious spot.
Well, what is occurring right now, I think, is horrible. I don't want to get into the political things, but put it this way. Anti-Semitism has a 2,000-year history. The Catholic Church denounced that in 1965, but it still goes on and on. And of course, there's certain individuals within Israel that have stoked these things up. One of them is, I don't want, anyway, I don't see how we cannot be aware of what is occurring as we speak.
I want to ask about the guy in your book, Cleet. I know he's not in all the books, and maybe not, I think maybe not in a couple of the early ones I read. And I'm curious as to what made you decide to add him as a character in the first place.
Well, I started off with the Neon Ring, and Cleet was in there, and he was not in Heaven's Prisoners, and he was not in in the Electric Mist with Confederate Dead. Those were the only two books that went to the screen without Cleet. I forget how many of them, 17 or 18. But anyway, people have for years have said, why not give Cleet position of a narrator? And I've just finally said, that's a good idea. And so it's an experiment. I hope people enjoy it.
Is he modeled after any real life person, or is he totally from your imagination?
Every high school has one guy like that. The guy that will do anything. If you just, if anyone listening out there, just think back and suddenly you will remember, oh yeah, that guy.
I assume you remember that guy from your high school.
Absolutely. But also the figure is a literary one. He's the trickster. Always getting in. He gets even for the rest of us. That's always been characteristic of the chief characteristic of the medieval, the folk plays of that era. And simple folk understood, and they loved that man. And he appears in other, but not like Cleet. I don't think there are lots of those kinds of guys. Louts, in other words, but Cleet is an intelligent man. He's an extremely intelligent man. But he and Dave, you see, share the same coin. They're the opposites of themselves, but each is dependent upon the other. There's certain things they never do. For example, they never use profanity in the front of a woman. They never speak in a derogatory way about women. They, oh my heavens, they never use God's name in vain. They actually are kind of prudes.
Well, it reminds me of something that Cleet says in this book, and I think it's said in a couple of the other books. He tells Dave that he should have been a priest. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's it. I mean, Dave is. He has these characteristics, and he's a man of honor. But the religion, what is the expression? Well, one man's religion is another man's superstition. All of our ethos, the Occidental world, is driven by Christianity. It is. That's just, it's, I didn't make that up. The ideas, of course, we're not always applicated successfully because human beings are going to be human beings. But Christianity drives every aspect of democracy. I've never figured yet how, and these are my ancestors, We, the white race in the South, were able to defend themselves as Christians and do the things that they did. But they, of course, people again are have ways of sunning, of getting around things.
Obviously, Dave and Cleet are, as you said, have this code, kind of a morality code, but they can also be very violent men. And I'm wondering how you see those things balanced against each other. Is there some way to square that morality, that code, with the violence that they do in their work? Or is it something that can't be squared? And maybe that's the tension of your books.
Number one, I think that the violence in my work is nothing compared to others, that both in the written word and, of course, film, the television, night television. And also, Dave and Cleet might seem like violent men, but they never act in a violent way except in protection of others. That's an enormous discrepancy between the use of most violence. Secondly, most of it's off camera. The people that they protect are those who have no voice. They're great characters, and I think they're exceptional.
When you started doing these books and you first wrote about Dave and Cleet, did you have in mind that this was going to be a series of books that I think there's like 24 of them now or something like that? Were you looking to do that, or are you just looking to write one story?
That's that one story. I had not been able to get back in print for 13 years, and I wrote many, many pages during those 13 years. And I published one paperback. Let's see, golly, two for Texas. But that's the only book I had in print for 13 years. And so I was fishing with my friend. He said, "Jim, why don't you just try writing a crime novel?" Or he said, "A detective novel." I said, "Well, I write crime novels. They're, I, to me, every you can't get rid of villains if you write about human beings. You can't just." My friend said, "Why don't you give it a try, Jim?" And I wrote two chapters. And I sent them to my friend Charles Williford in Miami. And he wrote me back. And he said, "Jim, you may have just created the best and most successful narrator in American crime fiction." I had just gotten an agent. I had not had one for years. But my agent was a cab driver. Philip Spitzer, I met him in Hell's Kitchen, and he drove a cab at night and ran his one-man agency during the daytime. He and I did pretty well finally.
When we come back, James Lee Burke talks about how he dives into a story without an outline.
Hemingway put it better. He said, "If I knew the end of the story, the reader would know the end of the story also." I see two scenes ahead of me, but that's it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with James Lee Burke. So during all that time, that 13-year fallow period, did you ever quit or consider quitting?
Oh, no, I never quit. No, never quit. Never quit. I never quit.
What do you think kept you going?
You don't quit. You're a quitter or a non-quitter. You just don't quit. You don't quit. The way to quit, to really destroy yourself, is to leave a manuscript at home. It guarantees failure. I started when I was a kid. I was 20 years old, working offshore oil drilling. 10 days on, 5 days off. I would send away my manuscripts. When I got the rejections, I would give myself 36 hours to put it back in the mail.
You mentioned that oil job, and I know you had a series of other jobs, both blue-collar jobs and white-collar jobs, before you became a full-time writer. What, if any of those jobs, kind of became the most useful to you in what you do now?
Yeah, all of them. I did lots of things, and I learned. I was an instructor in the Job Corps, the Forest Service. I was a long-haul truck driver. I worked a little bit offshore drilling, seismograph drilling. Oh, golly, I was a pipeliner in Texas. I was a surveyor in Colorado. I was a caseworker on Skid Row. That was where I was assigned in California. Worked with this criminally insane. Oh, golly, I taught four universities and one junior college. I was a journalist. Golly, my wife and I, this is how we put it. I drove a truck and she was a waitress. She had a PhD and I had a master's, and we did every kind of dirty job. And this is a fact, from Florida to California, we did everything kind of job you can do. And we did it from one coast to the other with four children.
Did you have that series of jobs because one of them would sort of run its course and you would leave or somewhat happen? Or were you like searching for something as you crossed the country doing this?
Searching for a paycheck. There's an expression back in the, I remember this when I was a kid in the 40s. You don't get no bread with one meatball. It's a tough world out there, Buster Brown. It is. Yeah, we lived in a slum, and we were poor.
There's a lot of talk in all the Robert Joe books about his childhood and how it shaped him. So what was your childhood like, and how did it shape you?
I'm very fortunate. I think my whole generation was fortunate. But that said, I think we are the last generation, the one that people will remember as what is called traditional America. I think we will not see that America again. And I know people say, I've had journalists say, well, Mr. Burke or Jim, everybody says that their generation was different. I don't say anything to them, but they're wrong. They are dead wrong.
And do you mean that in a, like when you think of traditional, do you think of that in a positive way?
Well, if, who was it, the playwright and a novelist, oh, golly, Herman Wolf, I forget. But he said, had it not been for those GIs, Hitler and Tojo would have shaken hands over the Mississippi River. What a great line. Gee whiz, that's it.
It is a great line.
That's it. And they were farm boys. And gee whiz, it makes you so proud. And my heavens, we are on the edge of what? Look at what we're doing. People who know better are about to vote in a man who lauds Mussolini. He's never taken to task for that. He praised Mussolini and how many other tyrants. This is the United States. I can't get over it. I cannot get over it. A man who mocked John McCain. John McCain was a statesman. He was a Republican. He was a soldier. He was a patriot. I never voted for him, but I respected him. I said, my God, this man is a man like Trump mocking John McCain? No, I just, it's contemptible.
I'm interested in how you develop your books, like from book to book. I've read writers who say, you know, they draw up a really detailed outline to begin with. And then I've read, like, Lee Child, for example, says he just sits down and starts writing and figures it out as he goes along. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, what was it again about Lee? And
like Lee Child says he just sits down and starts writing and kind of goes from there. I've heard other writers who have a really detailed outline. What's your process like?
Yeah, well, I would go with Lee on that. my first novel, I kept notes and or rather outlines. I outlined a little bit, but not since then. And I never know where the story is going. It probably shows. But Hemingway put it better. He said, if I knew the end of the story, the reader would know the end of the story also. And I've always understood that. I didn't learn that from him. It's just the way I see two scenes ahead of me, but that's it.
That's that. Is it E.L. Doctorow who said, it's like driving at night with the lights on. You don't know, you can't see all the way to the end, but you can see far enough to keep going.
That's pretty good.
I know that you, obviously there's talent, but there's also work involved. I've read many interviews with you where you said you write every single day. And at 87, is that still true?
Oh yeah, no, not just every day. I write night and day. I do it in the middle of the night. I go to 11 o'clock at night. No, I don't shut down until 11 at night. But anyway, no, I don't see how anyone cannot write. It's the best life in the world.
I read somewhere that you mentioned that occasionally when you're in the middle of writing, you'll have what you described as sort of a blackout, where you would kind of not realize what you'd written and kind of come out of it, and there would be pages and pages. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, no, I don't remember. I don't remember the work. I can start rereading it. I mean, I don't even recognize it sometimes in 24 hours, but I'm not the only one. Hemingway and Faulkner both said something. You know, Faulkner was thrown by a horse and he was, you know, he died right after that. And he said, somebody had asked about his work and he kind of brushed it off and said, had I not written the books, another hand would have written them for me. And then right before Hemingway's death, before he took his life, he called his wife in Florida, Haley. He said, I reread The Old Man and the Sea, and it was strange, and it was as though I did not rewrite it. And Hemingway was not humble. Go around saying that it like someone else wrote it. But that's what he said. All artists know that. They all know it. It's out there. It's a voice that's out there. George Orwell wrote a great essay titled Why I Write. And he speaks about these things. He says every writer has a message he needs to give to other people. And he will never have peace until he gets it out there in some way, some fashion. And every writer, artist hearing this now knows what I'm saying.
I have one last thing I want to ask you. Your series of books can obviously go on as long as the writer wants them to. But I think, you know, when you think of TV series or something like that, you sort of start thinking about endings. And I wonder if you've ever thought about or considered how you might want the Dave Robichaux series to end.
It's not going to end. It's still an end. It's like, it's just, you don't end. It doesn't end. Okay, this is what I believe, and it's metaphysical, that the one, maybe there might be more than one category here, but for what I've seen, that the only activity that we actually do in the same way that God does is creation. That's it. It's like a baptismal fount. Once you do that, you step into infinity. It has no end. Age takes its it can be hard sometimes, right? But that doesn't, I think, take away from our talent. If you've done it before, you can do it again. You can do it in a library. You can talk to people. It doesn't matter. But once you've joined that group, you're in, brother. You're in the kingdom. Why give it up?
I read James Lee Burke's new book to get ready for this interview. Then I went back and reread two others before I talked to him. And since our conversation, I've burned through four more of his novels on the stack that I have stashed on the bookshelf next to the bed. I've been addicted to his books for going on 30 years. His stories are dark and violent, and his characters end up down in the mud, literally and figuratively. But the books are also cathartic. First of all, the good guys generally win. And second, you end up feeling so glad that they're doing the fighting and not you. It's funny to hear Burke talk. There's a lot of gosh and golly coming from a guy who has created so many ruthless villains. But it makes sense when you think about his heroes like Dave Robichaux and Clete Purcell. Terribly flawed people, to be sure, but people who try to live a decent life and act with a moral code. If Burke has a code, it's probably two words. Keep working. I have to say, as a writer, it's intimidating to open one of his novels and turn to the page with that long list of books he's already written. But how does that happen? You create every day, even when you're 87, and probably have all the money you ever need. You create, as he says, to touch infinity. The work makes you immortal. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.